welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz. I've survived the extreme vetting process, and I'm allowed to sit at the keys. So
Extreme. Let me say it again. Extreme vetting.
Extremely vetted.
Extreme vetting.
Not just regular vetting.
No. None of that regular vetting. Extreme vetting.
I've been extremely vetted.
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today we will be talking about the burkini, and if you don't know what that means, then you don't vacation much in the south of France. Several seaside French towns have passed or are considering bans on a full-bodied swimsuit worn by Muslim women at the beach, but is this France's niqab moment? And then we will talk about whether or not you can tax the wind. Does that sound weird? Well, Wyoming's already doing it, and it's threatening to end potentially lucrative and sustainable wind power developments. We'll talk about why the reddest of red states is so tax-happy and why it's likely doomed to fail. And then finally, we will be talking about the revelation that a Canadian company has been selling armored personal carriers to countries that you probably wouldn't want to sell candy to. It raises, again, the moral quandary of what's more important, good-paying Canadian jobs or selling armaments to potential monsters. But first, we're going to refer to a recent story on Slate, the website, the web magazine Slate, about whether or not the life of democracy can now be measured with an egg timer. And the article written by, I don't know if I'll get this name correctly, but Yesha Monk posits that the week of July 11th, 2016 may be long remembered as the death knell of liberal democracy. Now, in case you forgot what happened that week, there was the attempted coup in Turkey. There was the Bastille Day terrorist attack in Nice. There was that was the week Theresa May became Prime Minister of not just Great Britain, but the United Kingdom, promising a number of Brexit moves forward. And that was also the week Donald Trump named Mike Pence his running mate, sort of solidifying his status as the Republican nominee for President of the United States by officially naming his running mate. The article basically says that all this points to the sign that, you know, liberal democracy is doomed, that we're given into fear and demagoguery. I did post the link on the our website, so if you did like your in-depth Open Sources pre-show research like you're supposed to, you probably read through that article, maybe read the comments. I certainly read
several times. And I've already written us a strong-worded letter.
Yes.
For whatever we're going to say. Yeah.
Well, nobody is, but it's, anyway. it's the internet. Yeah, the response, to, if you read the comment section, was kind of like, well, this is bollocks, but... I think there's a point to be argued in this. Perhaps if it really isn't yet the death knell of liberal democracy, there's certainly some warning signs along the way here, Scotty.
Yeah, what did he change it? He calls it illiberal democracy now, or undemocratic liberalism, a couple of variations on the same theme. And there's some truth to it, I think, considering how that week went, because it was so, oh my goodness, so much happened. A related article harkened back to whose article was it? Famously, the end of history, saying that liberal democracy in the late 80s, when the wall fell and the Soviet Union blew apart within 2 or 3 years, that it was pretty much capitalism had won, and all we're going to see from that point on is liberal democracy. Well, wasn't that myth busted? One of the common threads of that particular week, the week of July 11th, was not the drive towards, but we'll call it the rise of the, I wouldn't even say benevolent dictator, the rise of the strong arm. We saw it in, not as much with Brexit, but in France with, once the, of course, what had happened in Nice was the car driving through the Bastille Day, people celebrating Bastille Day, of all faiths, of all political persuasions, truck drove through. Who benefits from that? Marine Le Pen of the, you know, French National Front, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in Turkey, the coup, or, you know, presumed coup or whatever was going on that week.
Attempted
coup. It was never really quite clear what was going on. But, of course, it was parlayed into something even more severe where the crackdown has been on, you know, I think it was like 26,000 people arrested, fired, judges, teachers, journalists, lawmakers, kind of round up the usual suspects. Let's just grab let's use this opportunity to grab everybody we possibly can, and you know, all resistance will be crushed, strong arming again. And then, of course, Trump, when we have Trump, and it is, you know, march to take back the country from the other, right? So we see this rise, and of course, all of them have in common is they're saying that, you know, the status quo will not help you, and that you need, it's implied that you need somebody like me in Trump's case, Le Pen's case, and maybe in O'Gordon's case. You need the benevolent dictator, not even so benevolent, to, you know, take charge of things and crush any opposition. And it seems a lot of people are all right with that, considering, you know,
yeah,
we see Trump supporters and supporters for the – it's and a lot turned out for in Turkey after the coup. It was like, you know, don't touch our government.
Yeah.
Right?
No, yeah. That was I think – I'm not sure what the – well, no, I am sure, but the argument that, yeah, a lot of people turned out. I mean, the Turkish president, whose name I can't recall.
Erdogan,
thank you. He, you know, rallied the troops, basically. There was the famous, like, holding the iPhone up to the megaphone so he could make the statement because, you know, he was so worried. But, I mean, he was the duly elected person. Who was became president of Turkey, and yeah, a number of his measures have sort of leaned to the more right-hand side of Islam. Let's say, you know, it's not like whole Sharia, but it's definitely not in terms of where people want Turkey to be, like sort of an example of Western liberalism in the Islamic world. It's certainly not that. What I took away from the article was we're doomed, which is why I put the little Walking Dead picture on the show notes.
Can be, yeah.
But I mean, I don't feel doomed, and maybe that's part of the problem. But I will, on the other hand, look at it this way: we're coming off a week of this particular week of you know, Trump having extreme difficulties trying to coalesce into a campaign where he can convince more middle-of-the-road type people, or even slightly to the right of the middle of the road, to come on board. So we saw that shakeup at Trump HQ, where he brought in Steve Bannon of Breitbart. It seems that Roger Ailes is sort of an unofficial member of the Trump campaign team. Like, they can't, like, he's not getting paid, but he's sort of standing by doing the debate prep, they're saying. The message from all that is, and it was sort of reinforced by Kellyanne Conway, his new campaign manager, was that they're going to run a campaign where they're not going to try to appeal to the middle, where they aren't going to try and make that what they call the pivot to the center, where he's basically going to run the same campaign that he ran in the primaries, which was to just be like as Trump as he wants to be. And that is probably unlikely going to win him any more votes than he has now when you're trying to win in general. So the appointment of the Breitbart, the former head of Breitbart, was especially interesting because what they're saying now is he's actually looking past the election, where he's not going to win, but, you know, he is going to use the sort of the following he has collected to launch a new alt-right media empire.
I think we say a reality show, but yeah.
Well, it's definitely have a reality show vibe with Steve Bannon. So, you know, when you're looking at it that way, how serious a threat could it be when, like, one of the serious threats isn't even taking himself seriously as a threat? And the other thing was that struck me was when you're talking about Le Pen, he mentions in the article that, you know, she could, or he could be, no, Marie Le Pen.
She sister.
Yeah,
or,
I was getting my...
Marine.
Yeah, I was getting my... I was thinking about the author of the article and Marie Le Pen and switching their pronouns, but that he said she could be president this time next year because France has an election. But I want to look at what happened after Brexit, where you had Nigel Farage, clearly the leader of UKIP, even though they don't have like power, like legislative power, that the Brexit vote was a victory for him. He could have like put himself in a prime position to have influence over the next several years in Britain as they move away from the European Union. But what does he do after Brexit? Resigns.
Ran away, yeah.
So, you know, how serious a threat could these be when these people who are posing the threat kind of not want to have the power they're seeking?
Yeah, it was like Johnson gone, Farage ran away, Cameron resigned, but, you know, and he was pro, like, remaining in the union. But, yeah, this is the thing, and the problem with Brexit and how it ties into the rest, too, is that it became all about immigration.
Yeah.
So once again, we're back to the other. Rather than all the ramifications of staying or going within the European Union, mostly economic, and of course there's this other, everything else that goes with that, the rule book that no one likes, it became about, they're taking over our country, you know, like,
yeah.
So that you're done. Now, as to whether the 52% consciously used that as the reason, because they did, you know, they spoke to a lot of people of various ethnicities and whatever who were voting to leave, but a lot of that to do, again, is with the European Union Parliament in particular being, as they see it, out of touch. It's just sort of these career bureaucrats that are making decisions in Brussels, nothing to do with the UK. So it's a combination of those things. You've got this undercurrent, this anti-immigrant undercurrent, but you've also got this, you know, I'm the person to take care of this because, you know, these idiots, as Trump would call them, aren't doing, you know, they're just career politicians. And that plays into a lot of people's, not fears, but, you know, they agree with that because they see it. It's like, I can't get anything done. I meet this wall of bureaucracy. I go back to the Fishers example where, you know, the people on the coasts in Britain were like saying the rest of the European Union is coming and mining the seas around the UK and the fish is going elsewhere. And that's just one example. You know, there's an industry that's left and, you know, struggling to survive and yet in belonging to the European community, they feel they're being robbed. So, of course, you know, that village or those towns are probably going to vote to leave. They're playing right into it. They're playing right into people's fears, and fear is huge in this. Fear of the other, fear of, you know, bureaucrats ruining your life, and they're going to tax us to death and we're not getting anything for it. So you can see where that's coming from. And it's interesting, though, in Turkey, I mean, it's not the opposite, but, you know, it's coming from a shall we say the opposite of what of Trump, in that it's you know, trying to prop up an Islamist view, I think, of things in a lot of ways. So it's different value system that conflict with each other, and yet structurally it's the same. You know, it's like I'm the strong man, I'm incorruptible, I'm patriotic, I love Turkey. Let's go bomb the Kurds because we don't like them. You know, pick your enemy, right?
I wonder to what degree it feeds into each other, where you have the demagoguery in the West that is looking at Islam as the enemy, and how many people, especially in some place like Turkey, which is kind of like the midway between the East and the West, is looking at that situation and saying, oh, geez, they hate us. You know, why are we bothering to try and make ourselves over to be more appealing to them? So the us versus them thing is maybe partially what's driving the situation in Turkey. The other thing, though, is just like straight up ignorance and unwilling to unignorant yourself, if that's a word, unignorant yourself.
It is now.
Sure. But it's tricky. Because you look at the Trump supporters, and we kind of come back to, I guess, because it's like in our backyard. But these are people who think the media straight up lies to them every day. They think
that's
that
what Trump's telling them too, though, right? So he's pointing them out and saying, "You're liars. You're this. You're
oh yeah.
You're
no.
ruining everything. You're spinning it all." And
it's like it's performance art, because there's always that moment where he's like, look at these lying, disgusting people in the back. And, of course, everybody turns. And because this was described in – I can't remember which article I read it in, but like the moment where Trump's like points out the press and the whole room with like 1,000 people in it turn to look at this little press pen they have, the press cordoned off.
I'm surprised he doesn't go, not you. You're okay. You know, like he's probably – you'll be fine.
But yeah, it's like science is a hustle. You know, everywhere you go, you see teachers driving Cadillacs and research scientists drinking champagne. That line from that classic line from Krusty the Clown. You know, it's really
all true.
Yeah, it's really incredibly, you know, messed up in terms of, like, you have low information people making decisions because they deem the more information to be a lie. They know what they know, and that's fine. And that's kind of where we get into, I think, these difficult decisions. And we saw that particularly in Brexit, where the next day everyone's like, what do you mean I can't get as many euros from my pounds anymore? It's like, well, you just voted to dash out of the union and the economy tank. What did you think was going to happen?
Or the movement to run it over again or change their vote. You know, if I could do it again, I would vote to stay.
Or all these people.
It's too late.
Or all these people who are like, well, maybe we could keep some European Union stuff and get rid of the stuff we don't like. And it's like, you don't realize a particular
That's right.
position that the UK was in already, where you aren't using euros in the UK. You aren't, you know.
We must keep the pound at all costs.
Yeah, there's exceptions to just about every European. Like, the UK is probably in, like, the catbird seat in the EU anyway. But it wasn't enough for some people. And that has to be an ignorance thing.
And now Theresa May, who campaigned to stay, is, well, no, we're actually going. So see how that transpires.
Well, that's, I mean, yeah, it's the will of the people thing. And, like, yeah, so take your medicine now. The thing, I think the lesson to take from it is that I think David Cameron learned too late was, you know what, you can't placate these people, because that's what he was trying to do when he said, well, yeah, let's vote on Brexit. He was trying to quell these voices in his own party saying, like, no, we got to get out, instead of, like, trying to explain to them the reason it's important to stay in the union, trying to, like, deal with it internally. But he was trying to score cheap political points, and he scored them, but he's still out of a job now.
Yeah, I'm figuring that reason would prevail, but of course the age of reason is gone, which is exactly what we're talking about. Democracy, is it dead? I don't know if it's dead. It's on life support, but we'll declare it just sort of on hold for now, just sort of suspended.
I don't know if it's suspended. I don't know. I'm not
suspended
even sure.
Animation.
I'm not even sure it's on life support. Certainly, like, it got, like, caught in an alley, and some street toughs like beat it with, like, baseball bats, and it's kind of made its way back to its apartment, and it doesn't want to go to the hospital because it thinks it's tougher than that.
Because you'd have to pay.
Yeah, because you'd have to, have to report it to the police. But yeah, I mean, I think there is hope. Again, the Brexit vote was pretty much everyone under 30 voted against it. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, we could just sort of rally
the millennials.
Yeah. And, you know, people who think government doesn't work. Well, government is people. So if government isn't working, it means the people aren't working. But again, that means confronting ignorance. And as we see with Trump, the yes, you can, which was actually at the Republican National Convention, them chanting yes, you can, is putting it all on Trump to fix all the problems, when the fact of the matter is, in democracy, is no, citizens create problems, citizens solve problems.
And thus ends today's lecture on Democracy 101.
Yeah, come to my seminar when we start. Fridays at 3 p.m. in Creelman. I don't know.
$10.
Creelman isn't a classroom. It's a...
all ages.
Yeah, anyway. we're going to talk next about the burkini, which I don't know how to describe it. It's like a scuba suit with a headdress is kind of what it looks like. But it's apparently has some appeal to Muslim women who, of course, believe in modesty and in covering themselves in public. It's kind of like the burqa niqab situation in that way. So if you want to go to the beach and you're a Muslim woman, you put on the burkini. A couple of things. I mean, it's been banned in 5 towns. There's three more towns that have a ban pending. It's become a big topic of conversation. The weird part is, and then, you know, as with all these issues, there's a weird part. You'd be hard-pressed to find any one of these politicians who are trying to get a burkini ban passed to admit that they had ever actually seen a burkini when they go to the beach. And it just feels like the niqab thing last year in Canada during the election. It feels like the niqab thing all over again. even though, you know, viscerally you do sort of agree with the liberal ideal that, you know, women shouldn't have to cover themselves up just because it's a religious thing. Yeah.
This does actually play back into topic one, because when was the ban on the head coverings in France? Was it 2010? So 4, 5, 6 years ago that they had that you couldn't, you know, you can't wear your head coverings to school. And I think it was all religious thing, you know, you're not supposed to wear an open crucifix. And then we saw it in Quebec, where they were trying to play into it as well. And it didn't work as well, because I think our rule book is a little different. Now, I mean, we know the French invented the bikini, right? They were the modern post-war bikini. The Beach Boys sang, "I dig a French bikini." They didn't just sing bikini. It was a thing, right? But now we have this other thing. And the bikini kind of harkens back to the bathing costumes of 100 years ago, when modesty was of the essence for everyone. You know, a woman showing a bit too much leg would be like, oh, our morals, my goodness. But I personally think they look pretty cool. There's lots of people competing in the Olympics with them on, and it's caused there was a picture kind of juxtaposing the Egyptian volleyball team, the women's, and the German. And the German women's obviously got, it's not even really a bikini, it's some kind of like minimalist sport outfit. I don't know if it's to do with aerodynamics or just to, for whatever reason she's wearing it. For whatever reason, the Egyptian team are wearing what they wear. And this is the key problem. Why does it matter what people are wearing on the beach? You could argue lots of ways for the bikini for non-Islamic reasons. You could say, I have a skin condition and I don't want to get melanoma, right? Mm. I don't want to get skin cancer, so I'm fully clothed. You could go to the beach wearing, say, long sleeves and a pair of yoga pants or something, right? Pretty close to a bikini, no head covering.
Mm.
Who cares? Who cares what – I mean, this is the problem with it. But they do care in a way that it is not just scoring political points. In Corsica, island of Corsica, which is part of France, the fight – if I understand it right, the fights on the weekend that prompted the ban, and I'm not sure if the ban in Corsica was temporary. I know the one in Cannes definitely is. The fight began when tourists were taking pictures of the women in bikinis. And I think the entourage or whoever was swimming got mad, and then became this riot, right? So, and I'm not sure whether it was locals versus maybe everybody's local. It was the local non-Muslim versus Muslim, or these tourists were involved. Details were kind of sketchy, but it was just like, okay, it's banned. It seems in the south of France, there's been at least 10 women charged, and they pay a fine. But the fine, it's not vague. It's just like they can only fine you once a day. And as far as I understand, the ban is only till the 31st, which I guess is when the high season is over for the beaches in the south of France.
Yeah.
And it would seem that the authorities in Italy have come out and said, you know, this is ridiculous. The French are handling it all wrong. Mm. I don't know if that's just to have one up on the French, but it's like, you know, it's like, why are you doing this? You'll just encourage, you know, it's like, oh, the French banned the burkini, so, you know, we should go bomb the beaches. I think that's the, you know.
Maybe Italy sees growth in its for its own beaches. Like, sure. You want to come down to Italy and wear your bikini? No big deal. Yeah, I mean, I get the liberal point of view about, you know, a woman shouldn't have to feel compelled to, like, cover up. And there is definitely a – I mean, I don't get anything about religion that demands you to wear something. I don't understand the whole thing. I mean, there's a thing in many religions where you have to hide the top of your head under, like, a yarmulke or a turban or something. I'm like, what is it about the top of our heads that is so offensive to gods across the pantheon? I don't know.
Let's cover the bald spot in men. Sorry.
That I would believe, but I mean, why? Anyway, so I don't want to get into like a theological argument, but still, I mean, I don't understand it at all. But to me, my response to this is, you know, let it happen. For a lot of particularly younger women, you know, who grow up immersed in these cultures, yeah, they're going to grow up in like, does it make a whole lot of sense for me to wear a full body suit to the beach if I'm not like scuba diving? You know, the culture the fact that it's so rare, you know, already says something. In fact, I read a thing that said most Muslim women who want to, you know, preserve their modesty when they're at the beach, wear like a long sleeve shirt and like long, like those long, like shorts, the, you know, and maybe like a hijab or like a swimsuit cap or something. I understand the impetus that if you saw someone in a burkini on the beach and took a picture, you didn't know it was a burkini. I would probably like take a picture and say something smart alecky on Twitter, like, "Hey, what's this ninja doing on the beach?" But I understand the various things involved. But my response is like the kneecap debate. It's like it's such a small minority of things. Why are we making it a federal issue?
Yeah, and I think what we're gonna see out of this, honestly, is that it's gonna become a style trend. Because this is what happens with you know, just fashion in general. And, you know, burkini is sort of beyond a fashion statement in terms of, you know, there's the religious involved with it. I think it's going to start to be a trend. I think we're going to see people showing up at the beach, let's say in solidarity with the other people that are wearing them. And it will become fashion. Because if you Google burkini and check out some of the ones that are there, some of them are actually quite stylish. It's a very stylish garment. Interestingly enough, there was one in French red, white, and blue. And now, how could you argue with that, really? I mean, it's like, you could say, oh, you're disgracing our flag or whatever, but
well, any more
liberty,
than like an
equality,
American flag poncho.
Fraternity, right? The three, yeah. You know, if you want those things, there it is right there, present on the beach. Because, you know, I've been was lucky enough to go to the south of France. It wasn't quite warm enough yet for burkinis or bikinis. But there's a lot of people, you know, probably should be wearing more or not wearing more. But again, is it my place to judge? Probably not. If you're comfortable wearing that on the beach, if you want to wear all the clothes in the world, if you want to let it all hang out, by all means, right? And there are beaches where you can do that, right? It's to everybody's taste. You say, you know, you have your own judgments as to like, oh my God, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. But it's like we really need to get to the point where it's, you know, the not just the fashion police, but the judgment police. And it's usually men. All of these mayors are men. Yeah. The most ridiculous argument I heard was the Villeneuve-Loubier, which is along the way a bit from Nice and Cannes, said that it is unhygienic to swim fully dressed. Where did you take your hygiene lessons? Like, who? You swim in a scuba costume, you're like fully dressed, right? I know it's a special outfit, but I guess you could potentially wear a scuba outfit with like a little, you know, a towel around you, and that's you fully covered, right? You know what I mean? That's like a burkini.
Yeah.
Should we get to the point where it matters? I mean, we're at the point where it matters a lot to these people, but. Maybe it's just a very Canadian response for us going like, whatever.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, we're looking at it far away too. And I think one of the things we have to keep in mind in this is like, how much is this a response to like a women's rights thing? And how much of it is a response to the fact that there have been three terrorist attacks in 18 months perpetuated by people of the Muslim faith? And perhaps, you know, for some people, that's one way of sticking it to those people by just, you know, trying to make things as un-Muslim as possible.
Sure. But of course, as I said earlier, the attack in Nice didn't really discriminate, right?
No.
That baby, the young, that famous picture of the teddy bear, that was a Muslim child, right? That was
cool. Yeah.
So.
But again, I mean.
Score the points, right? Yes. Yeah, we're going to punish those guys.
Right. Exactly. Anyway, we're going to take a break and do a little bit of a tribute, I think. And we'll let you figure that out when we hit play on the music, and then we will come back with some more discussion, because this is Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Hi, I'm Braden.
Lena.
Ira.
Svieta.
Daniel.
Elliot.
Chantal.
And
Oksana.
Fiona.
Joel.
Emma.
Jimmy.
Dima.
Amara.
And we're Canada World Youth.
And you're listening to 93.3 FM CFRU.
Drain out.
And that was a band called The Tragically Hip from their EP, which I think is probably an original to the station from back in the day. Yes, it's vinyl, folks, called The Tragically Hip. That song was called Last American Exit. The song on that album you would know was called Small Town Bring Down. And I believe they did a couple of EPs or a couple of an EP and an LP for RCA. And then they became the band we know. I think it was with Small Town Bring Down. And what was the Happy Hour, I think, was the hit after that. So if you know, that to me is the sound of the 80s. So if you remember the 80s, you'll know that sound, even though you probably don't know that song. Last American Exit, it's called. So that may be the last time you hear it. I don't know.
Wow. That's,
I don't think they're
doing it. That's fatalistic.
No, I don't think that. No, I didn't mean it like that. It's just that I don't think that they'll do it at their concert. So.
No, I don't.
We are mandated to play the non-hits on this show, right? So.
Very true. Yeah, it's sad. It's that it's coming to an end. I mean, I was never a huge hip fan. I think I'm going to go out and say something controversial. I think a lot of people are claiming hip acumens because of what's happened, the sad news about Gordon Downie's condition. But I don't dislike their music. I've never been a fan. And
they're not a diehard.
I've never been a diehard. I mean,
they're the type of band that has their like devotees, right?
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Super fans, and then it's kind of like Bob Dylan. There's people that really like Bob Dylan, and then there's like, what the heck
like,
was
I
that?
I like Rolling Stone.
Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, no, and I'm the same, and I'm like that. It's just, I remember a lot of the cool kids in high school, like the Tragically Hip, and since I'm, in case you didn't know, I was far from one of the cool kids.
They didn't
kids,
beat on you if you didn't like them. Sorry, come
oh,
on.
I didn't get,
you need to learn the lyrics.
That wasn't why I was beat on, but.
That might be a topic for another show.
Yeah. We'll save that for the special call-in therapy show we're planning for October. I don't know. Anyway, Last American Exit seemed apropos because a company, an American company, might be exiting Wyoming. They're trying to build a wind farm. And this is big business. This is an emerging industry. Power of the future, jobs of the future, all that stuff. So you'd think, well, there are a lot of places around who are trying to attract these kind of jobs, like tax incentives and, you know, come to our town, we'll do anything for you, especially in Wyoming where there is a lot of wind. They're like right along the Rocky Mountains there. A lot of wind comes up over those mountains. But not Wyoming. No, no, no. They tax wind in Wyoming. This is actually something that's been going on for 4 years. And the reason you haven't heard about it is because they've collected a sum total of $15 million from their wind taxes so far. But there are a couple of things going on here. First of all is Wyoming's number one industry is oil, gas, mineral extraction, coal, and that kind of thing, which has all kind of been going downhill. Because coal is, you know, becoming less and less used in the United States. It's been, you know, like quietly trying to put it out of business. And the oil prices crashed last year. So Wyoming's hurting for revenue. About $500 million, whole budget hole they're trying to fill. And I guess they're going to try and fill that with wind tax.
Yeah, of course, you'll never ever fill that gap with that, for sure. And everyone is looking for new sources of revenue. I think some of the arguments against, you know, Wyoming, where it's situated, has lots of wind, right? It blows off the Rockies. It's supposedly the windiest state, the windiest place, possibly in one of the windiest places in North America. And now that the end of supposedly cheap power, coal is upon us, I don't think they've opened a new coal mine in Wyoming in about 10 years. But there's still lots there, and there's still lots, and it fuels America. There were, of course, tariffs put on it and I wouldn't say beaten down, but the initiative from Obama, at least, was clean power. What was it, 20% by 2030? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like Hillary Clinton has bumped that up and she's saying that she wants to see like a 33% clean power for the U.S. And I suppose that includes – I'm not sure if their clean power includes nuclear, but of course it includes wind. I think currently it's something like 15 – it might not even be as high as 15%. 7? Very low, anyway, the amount of energy they're getting from wind. So it sounds like that this may kill this project. And ironically, Carbon County is where it's situated. They're going to put all these windmills in Carbon County. But some of the argument against it is that the power that's generated, because Wyoming isn't very populous. A lot of it's Yellowstone Park. A lot of it is I don't is there like there may be 500,000 people in Wyoming.
It's the, yeah, I think they have one congressperson.
Second least populous. Like, yeah. Vermont is the lowest, and there may be as many people in Wyoming as there is in the Tri-Cities here. So most of the power will be exported. It sounds like the inputs, the windmills themselves, have to come from other states. I think Colorado was mentioned. Iowa also build wind turbines. The jobs that have disappeared in coal, it's not very easy to retrain people that have worked in coal to work with wind power. Not only that, the quantity of the jobs will be much less.
Yeah.
Once a wind farm's up and running, you need a certain amount of personnel, but obviously it's not as many as it is to run a coal mine. So right. There are these factors at play. You know, does it actually help the people of Wyoming? I guess some degree, because you can say, hey, we're generating all this clean power. But is it the economic panacea that they sort of tout wind or alternative energy to be? And it isn't necessarily. So then they'll need to look beyond wind a bit. But will they raise the money that they're hoping for with the taxes? Not a chance. Will it kill the project? In all likelihood, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It just seems weird. Like, let's tax the wind. You know, you're going to collect wind. We're going to tax.
They're like the only ones, right?
Yeah, and I suppose in a sense it isn't weird, because you pay back to the government when you extract oil or minerals or precious stones. The government gets a cut. So should it not be the same with wind? I don't know. But it does feel weird. It, you know, what are they going to do next? Like, tax the sun rays? They're going to build a solar farm somewhere and then tax you for the sun rays you collect?
It's like rainwater charge, yeah.
The fascinating part about all this is they are trying to close that $500 million gap, which, again, comes from fossil fuels. So they're doing the same things that they've always done. Is they've built this economy based on, I mean, it's almost like a microcosm of what we're seeing here and in other places around the world, where they've built an economy built on collecting the fees and revenues of the extraction industry, which, for the health of the planet, amongst other reasons, we're trying to move away from. Now, the question is, can you replace that kind of revenue hole by applying the old rules to the new systems? And I think the answer is pretty obviously no. Now, Wyoming is also, by virtue of its of where it is in the United States and the kind of people who are there, highly conservative. They do not like to pay taxes, which is another one of this, which when I kind of heard about this, it struck me as weird. It's like, this is a place where they don't like paying taxes, but they're putting this tax on the wind. Talk about frivolous taxes. So, you know, that's how it got me into this issue. And then, like, sort of dissecting, it's like, okay, now I understand they're trying to replace revenue from oil, which isn't there, and coal, which isn't there anymore. But still, it seems like such an unconservative ideal that we're going to tax something to a point where it may not even get started. And Bill Miller, who's the CEO of PowerCo, great name if you have a wind power company.
Sounds like one of the movies.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back at PowerCo, yeah.
Exactly. He said in a piece, I think it was in the LA Times, where he said, just about every legislator we've met with asks us, you tell us how much we can tax before we put you out of business. Can you imagine if, I don't know, like a shoe factory tried to open up in Guelph and city council went to them and said, how much can we tax you before we put you out of business? Or let's say even, you know, a car parts factory, or even, not even something like that. Somebody wants to take water out of the ground and put it in bottles and ship it places. What if we, you know, they went down there and said, well, how much can we tax the water until you would have to shut the front doors?
I would do that. But anyway.
that was last week's discussion. But yeah, that seems like, for a conservative place that hates taxes, likes business, likes making money, likes industry, it just seems so antithetical to then turn around and say, give us a number we can tax you with. I mean, I can't think of anything that sort of betrays sort of the underlying mythology of the United States than hearing Bill Miller say that.
But it's a reason, though, because I think in some ways it's a bit of a punishment, right?
Sure.
Coal is taking a beating.
Yeah.
King Coal is down in the dumps. a lot of the people who lean to the conservative side of things don't believe that climate change is reality. So, you know, yeah. So wind is one of the solutions for clean energy, and they see it as hippy-dippy stuff, and it's like, you know, how can we pound you? But it really is a massive business opportunity. The price you can sell power to California is twice of what it costs in Wyoming. It's cheap in Wyoming. I think something like 7 cents versus 14 – or sorry, 16 cents, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. California, they pay a premium for it because it's alt energy, right? So if they were smart, wouldn't the Wyoming government be all over this and say, why don't we build it ourselves? Or is that a little too non-conservative, saying, hey, why don't we build, rather than have private interest do it, because it's all about private interest in the States in terms of power, completely different world from Canada in terms of who owns power. I mean, every time they go and sell anything in Ontario Hydro or Ontario Power Generation, people lose their minds in Ontario. Whereas in the States, it's just like, it's whatever. There's lots of power cooperatives in the States.
Private industry can do it better, they always say.
Yeah, exactly. But if you had some windmills yourself, your $500 million deficit would go away almost immediately if you were running it. But of course, that's anti-capitalist. You know, I'm gonna have it. So as to whether, and if I understand it right, I can't recall his name, but if I understand it right, the person that's building or intends to build this energy project, and also the power line that's going to feed into Las Vegas and on to California, is a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, they're sort of beating on their own.
Yeah, and then the governor of Wyoming sort of staying off to the sides in terms of which way is going to fall on this, which, I mean, sort of symbolizes to me the internal struggle that's going on in conservative politics in the States, where, you know, there are a lot of politicians who recognize that they have to embrace change, but
not climate change, but just change. Yeah.
Well, there are conservative politicians who recognize the problem. They're not all Jim Inhofs who find a snowball outside and think, well, this global warming thing can't be real.
That's funny, because I was looking at the Wyoming tourism website. One of the big things they have is dinosaurs, not unlike Alberta, right? It's like, come see our dinosaurs. Like,
well, it's, yeah, same neighborhood.
It makes me want to go to Wyoming and look at the dinosaurs and the windmills, so.
That's a good trip.
Yeah, I think so.
And good hobbies.
Could be the first open sources road trip. Reporting from Wyoming on our pod thingy.
Anyway, this is a bit more serious, but still in the area of business. There's a company called The Street Group. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it.
I think it's Strite. Yeah,
Streit. Street Strite. Strite Group. They have a factory in the United Arab Emirates that exported about 173 of these armored transport vehicles to the South Sudan in 2014. But if that wasn't enough, this company also supposedly shipped about 131 to Libya in 2012. Now, if you remember where Libya was in 2012, it was a little bit of a fustercluck, let's say. It was right after the civil war there. It was right after they caught Gaddafi. It was basically the old West in Libya at the time. But here is this company, this Canadian company, Street, selling armored vehicles to places that perhaps they shouldn't be. And the Canadian government has apparently decided that is worth looking into.
Or so they say. I mean, I think what's going to happen, going back to the Libya, and we've talked about this before, when everything was going for a dump in Libya and Gaddafi was on the run, who went? John Baird went with business leaders. Suncor went, SNC-Lavalin, who were in trouble there as well,
right,
with some dirty dealings. I don't know if Strite was on that tour as well, but the whole idea was that let's do some business with this country, or the new version of this country, which obviously in 2012 would have been the new version. So the logic was, okay, it's open for business. Now, you could argue with these vehicles that they're not, you know, they're armored transports. They don't come with guns necessarily, but the gun is an option. If you've seen the picture of some of the ones in South Sudan, you just need, you know, the gun is optional. You just mount it to the top, and then it becomes more like a tank, right? You can attack people. You can run over them, whatever. But yeah, the sheer quantity of the vehicles that went alone would lead you to say, what? Like, that's a lot. But also, in doing a bit of research, and this wasn't mentioned in the Murray Brewster articles on CBC, because I always try and look for the links. Like I say, I can't prove the link between the John Baird visit And Strait, that's, you know, I have no backing for that. However, Strait North Carolina branch in 2014, I believe, were charged, this was in a civil case, fined $3.5 million for the illegal export and unlicensed transfer of armored vehicles to Venezuela and the United Arab Emirates. So I think they might have been doing a bit of a shift of like Venezuela would have still been under
embargo.
Yeah. So they were fined. And German Guderoff, who is the chair and CEO, the Canadian, who's actually Russian origin, doesn't matter. He's Canadian. And one of the executives in North Carolina were both charged. And it seems that the president of the American division, Eric Carlson, lied about the transfer of these vehicles. So there's a bit of a history here, right? As to how deeply this is going to be pursued, we'll see. The UN themselves are saying, look, you've broken the rules by doing this. I think the argument's going to be, well, they weren't armed when we sent them.
Oh, right? That's definitely
it'll
the argument.
Be like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. But it's kind of like, you see these the trucks in Libya, like a pickup truck, they mount a gun to it and then it becomes essentially a vehicle of war. Like, you're going to sue Toyota because their truck was used in that? No. But it's a little bit different when it's like an armored vehicle is a pretty heavy duty. It's almost a tank. Oh, no, but Trudeau called them Jeeps. That was the best. They said, like, well, we sent some Jeeps. It's like, no, you've got it wrong there, son. They're not just Jeeps. There's a different, there's somewhere between a Jeep and a tank.
I think the last time a Jeep was considered an armored transport carrier was like the Korean War.
MASH.
Yeah, the MASH. When, you know.
It's like tinfoil, made of tinfoil.
When like a helicopter was like one of those hamster balls with a propeller on it.
That's right.
But it's kind of hard to, this isn't the first time this has come up this year. Remember, we were talking in the spring. Or maybe it was like even the late winter when the Saudi deal came up. And if you think Saudi Arabia is sketchy, that's nothing compared to South Sudan, where the UN report said that the Sudan People's Liberation Army was accused of conducting a, quote, scorched earth campaign, which just basically is as horrible as it sounds, which is just like they would go through a place and like leave no building standing, leave no person unharmed.
If you have lab vehicles, it's really easy to do that.
Well, yeah, because they're all terrain, right? Yeah. And they're armored. And yeah, we can make the armor. Well, they didn't send them out with machine guns, but certainly they are capable of being mounted with machine guns. It's like when you get the basic play set and you can add the various pieces on it to enhance it and make it your own. That's what these vehicles are. They're, you know, you can paint them and mount your machine gun and stuff guys in them and have like a machine gun armory in the back and all this sort of thing. It is really quite disturbing that in the midst of terrible civil wars, terrible conflicts where innocent people are being harmed, we're enabling the harm of innocent people with a company that seems to be just fine selling dozens of vehicles to people who, if they were a street gang in Winnipeg or Toronto, we'd probably have extreme hesitation about selling people like that equivalent vehicles.
Yeah, but because it's somewhere else, it's like no one.
Exactly.
Like, oh, well. And also, part of it too is the whole jobs angle, in that the General Dynamics are based in London, Ontario, where they make those vehicles. And London hit really, really hard by the death of manufacturing, killed off by various forces. So we've got this one little light, I guess you'd call it, on the horizon of something, working factories. Same with Strait is in Innisfil, Ontario. Yep. I don't think the vehicles made there are going to were the ones that ended up in South Sudan.
Yeah, they have.
It sounds like there's a bit of laundering going on. They went through the UAE. Maybe parts of them are made here and then sent over.
Yeah.
But it, it's still. Seems if you look at it, not even remotely deeply, it's seems pretty sketch. If you're touting yourself, your nation as being this for human rights and for whatever, and that's like, nah, well, we got these armored vehicles, and we can't control what they do with them. You know damn well what's going to happen with them. It's kind of like Ford sending equipment to the Nazis, right? Like,
right.
It's to me, it's at par with that.
Yeah, it's it is sketch, but I mean, there is that the quandary of the good paying jobs, and who, you know, who else is going to buy armored vehicles other than people who want to use them, right? It's a difficult discussion, and you know, I think unlike the wind issue, and I mean it is kind of like the wind issue where, you know, if we're not going to be digging for coal anymore, what are we going to do? And what are those people going to do? If we're not going to be building armored cars anymore, what are those people going to do? What are they going to build? It's difficult to understand that, but, you know, I think it's also unacceptable that, yeah, that, you know, the UN is investigating these atrocities and Canadian fingerprints are on it, quite literally.
Yeah, but you could argue that, like, could you not build vehicles for peace? Do we even, like, there's no domestic car. There's no Canadian vehicle. You know what I mean? Could you not build cars? Could you not build... Is that not lucrative enough, or do you have to build these things? I mean, they do armored cars as well, which you could argue was a defensive thing. It's like, I don't want to be blown up by the insurgents, so I'm going to drive around in an armored limousine or whatever. But, you know, it's where the bucks are and the jobs, influence, and... You know, these companies obviously have a lot of pull. And I should mention that the Saudi deal wasn't just, you know, a company dealing with the Saudis. It went through the Canadian Commercial Corporation, which is a federal entity.
Right.
Which is that was devised after the Second World War to kind of broker deals specifically with national security needs, but also a bit of infrastructure as well. So, if, you know, country X needs to defend themselves against whatever, they will be involved in the deal. So they're trying to pass it off as if the government was kind of hands off, was like, oh, it was a, you know, this company arranged it. Not true. It was the Canadian Commercial Corporation, which is actually an arm of the government. So they're right in the way. They can try and distance themselves as much as they like. You know, if you look at the signed documents, there's government fingerprints all over it. So they have to be accountable and held accountable to that. And if enough people care about it, then it's like, you need to come up with alternatives for not only selling armored vehicles to whom they sell them to, but also for the workers, if that is indeed why, that, you know, one of the reasons why they don't want to go after this is because of the jobs issue, then, you know, they have to sort it out.
And that's the real tricky part is awareness, because I don't think anybody other than the CBC really picked up on this. I can't remember finding too many sources beyond the CBC. Like, I mean, the Tai and like a couple of the alternative places, yeah, like were they picked up on the CBC story, but it was the CBC doing the digging.
Yeah, and is this is not to split hairs, but is Murray Brewster a contractor? I don't know him as a CBC person. I think maybe it's a story that they picked up from somebody.
It might have been a freelance.
Sorry, Murray Brewster, if you've been a CBC guy for 40 years, but honestly, you know, I follow the station. Like, I hadn't really heard of the guy. But he could be a radio guy. It could be a radio.
We'll find out.
Clarify, it's, I guess.
But yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is, but CTV
it's
has...
It's good that they're doing it.
Yeah, CTV has Ben Mulrooney's morning show coming up next week, so he'll tell us what to do.
And didn't Anne-Marie Medawake defected or something?
Yeah.
Right? So.
Yeah. Sure did, because nothing's better than working with Ben Mulrooney.
I wish to defect. I liked the CBC News in the Evening with them on. I don't know what to...
Maybe Dwight Trumman's a jerk.
Oh, I don't think so. I think Dwight's one of the best. So.
Well,
wow, did we digress there? where did that go? Yes.
I think we're two of the best. Yeah, there we go.
I'll second that.
Excellent.
Shall we toot our own horns?
Excellent.
Trump style. I think I'm the best at this very job here.
Folks, that's the end of Open Sources this week. We are a rerun on Monday mornings as well at 6 a.m., so if you're up that early, by all means, check us out. You can connect with us all week long at opensourcesguelph.com, on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and on Twitter at OS_Guelph. And, of course, feel free to download Open Sources on the Guelph Podcast channel on Podbean, and you can also find us on iTunes. You can connect with me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or at my blog, guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at a place called The Spanner Book.
And until we see you next week, we'll just phase out. I'm not sure if DJ Sounds Good to Me is going to be here in person or if it's a rerun. But we'll have more music for you here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio and Open Sources Guelph. We'll be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. Same bat time, same bat channel. We will see you then.